This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. If you subscribe to The New Yorker or just pick it up while waiting at the dentist's office, you probably start by flipping through and looking at the cartoons. Our guest Matthew Diffie's cartoons appear regularly in The New Yorker, but even he every week has to deal with most of his submissions being rejected by the editors, a process that Diffie says may or may not involve the use of darts. But Matthew Diffie deals well with this rejection. He's just come out with his second volume of The Rejection Collection, drawn from the hundreds of cartoons rejected by The New Yorker each year. The appendix in the back of the book lists 10 possible reasons why cartoons get rejected. It includes too lowbrow, too weird, too dumb, too dirty, and too bad. Diffie has had more than 100 cartoons published in the magazine during the 8 years he's been a contributor. Well, Matthew Diffie, welcome to Fresh Air. This book has some very funny rejected cartoons in it, and I thought we'd begin by me sharing one of my favorites, which is one that you did that did not make it into the magazine, and it's a picture of an elephant in a zoo, and there's a sign facing the visitors which reads, "Please do not feed the animals chili."
Yes, well, the fact that that's your favorite tells me a lot about you, and this should be a fun interview.
Yeah, what does it tell you?
I don't know. You go for the sophomoric lowbrow stuff.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Right. A cruder sensibility than many.
The funny thing to me about these cartoons in this book is that we actually submitted them to The New Yorker. Like a joke like that, which is, you know, essentially a farting elephant gag. At some point, some inner critic didn't talk me out of submitting it to The New Yorker.
I'm wondering how, you know, writing for this medium, a single panel cartoon, is different from other forms of humor.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's really hard. I've written stand-up material, and I've written some, you know, longer form stuff. To me, it's so precise and so boiled down, and combining the element of the visual with the verbal, it's a really tough thing. And you can't count on any sort of performance ability. Like when you're writing a stand-up joke, you can kind of count on the comedian doing a funny voice or his timing or like the rhythm of it following a series of other jokes. But a cartoon stands alone, or it has to do everything in a really short amount of time.
Tell us a little bit about just the basics. I mean, how many cartoonists are working every week? How many they submit? What the vetting process is?
Yeah, there's probably, I guess, between maybe 20 and 50 cartoonists who appear in the magazine on somewhat a regular basis. Some people, of course, more often than others. And we all do about 10 ideas a week and bring them in or mail them in, fax them in to Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor. We do that on Tuesday. Bob then goes through them and picks his favorites and takes them to David Remnick, the editor of the magazine. And on Thursday, we will get a phone call saying we sold one, or we will get nothing if we didn't sell one. And on a good week, that's what you do. You sell one out of your 10 batch. So, you know, a 90% rejection rate is actually really, really good.
Wow. This collection of cartoons that didn't make it into The New Yorker is mostly not your work. You have you have 38 cartoonists here, and you have some examples of each of their work that didn't make it into the magazine, but you also have an interesting way of kind of having them present a self-biography. Would you describe what you did?
Well, the idea is that people know the New Yorker cartoons, but they don't know the New Yorker cartoonists. And I think that's a shame because these people are wonderful, creative, you know, interesting people. So I put together this questionnaire that they all have to fill out. And, you know, it's coming from me, so it's already a little bit of a weird, twisted sort of questionnaire. And they all do the same questions in really different, unique ways. I think it's probably my favorite part of the book. But I'm asking stupid questions like, have you been mooned or mooned more often in your life? And it's interesting to see what Roz Chast or somebody, you know, that you know as a New Yorker cartoonist has to say about that. Or on a scale of 1 to 10, how Jewish are you?
I actually remember Roz Chast's answer, I think, to whether you've been mooned or mooned more. Do you remember it?
I don't remember it, actually.
I think she said, "I'm mooning you right now."
Oh, yeah. I've been always impressed. If you give these setups to the cartoonists, they just knock it out of the park, you know, and it's really becomes a nice theme through the book to compare people's, the way that people think. You know, sometimes they do the same thing, and then sometimes they do things that only they could do. But it's a very entertaining part. And also I had them take photographs of themselves this year. They had to take a photograph of their face and of their hands and of their feet and of their refrigerator and of their drawing space. I think that's it. So everyone did that on their own in their own different way. It's certainly a glimpse into how their mind works.
Right. I have to correct what I said earlier. When I thumbed through the book, it was not Roz Chest who said, "I'm mooning you right now," but one of the cartoonists did indeed say that.
It would be funnier if it was Roz Chest, I think.
But, well, she missed that chance.
Yeah.
Could you pick a cartoon that you like, and if you can, tell us how you came up with it?
Well, I can tell you about one that people apparently like a lot of mine. It gets reprinted a lot. It's a cartoon. I'll have to describe it, which to me is already funny, doing cartoons on the radio. It's Che Guevara, or however you say his name. I don't even know how, but Che wearing a T-shirt. And, you know, people probably know the picture, the T-shirt with Che's face on it. So this is him wearing a T-shirt, and instead of, well, the face on his shirt is Bart Simpson. So it's a purely visual gag, and I know how I came up with that because I moved to Williamsburg in Brooklyn, which is where all the hip kids live, and I don't quite fit in. But I started to see this T-shirt on the subway, you know, ad nauseum, perhaps, and then I figured out, okay, that is something going on in the culture, and it's visual, and I can reference it. And so then it wasn't long before I got the idea, okay, I'll put him in a T-shirt. And once I had that, then it was just a matter of, going through the potential revolutionary figures that he would have on his shirt, and I settled on Bart.
Right. And that one made it into the book.
That one made it into the New Yorker, actually.
Right, right.
And but usually I just start with a phrase, you know, something that like, for instance, the one you mentioned with the chili, you know, please don't feed the animals. That's usually what the phrase is, but you can often add a word on to the end of something like that. And then when you combine it with an elephant and chili, to me, it makes a complete idea.
Right.
I'll often do that. I'll take a phrase and tweak one word or change it or add a word. I had a cartoon with a waiter bringing out plates to a table like in New York, and he's saying, "Careful, these plates are extremely dirty," which is just changing the one word that you expect with a surprising word, which also has another additional idea of meaning, because that is really more frightening than a hot plate is a dirty plate.
Right. So there's a little trick of the trade. Add the word. Right. And with the elephant cartoon, I mean, it could have been, please don't feed the animals chili. You could have put a raccoon, but this enormous elephant, he's somehow looking as if I got a little indigestion.
Well, that's good. If I actually drew an elephant that can put across the idea of I don't feel so good, that would be great. But yeah, it's a combination. And I had a tendency when I started out in Mankoff, the cartoon editor, who I don't want to paint as a bad editor. He's not, you know, there's just too many cartoons for him to put in each issue of the magazine. But he told me early on, he said, you know, don't write stand-up jokes. And I had a tendency to do that. I would write a joke that's perfectly funny by itself, and then I would simply draw a person saying it to another person. And that, you know, you can get away with that sometimes, but it's not a pure cartoon, because a cartoon needs one part of it needs to be dependent on the visual, either the setup or the punchline. Either one can be visual, but it needs that to be a pure cartoon in my mind.
Pick a few cartoons from the book and ones that can be described on the radio, and tell us why they may have been rejected. I assume you don't get a reason. It just doesn't make the cut, right?
Yeah, you don't get a reason, but some of them, certainly in this second volume, you can kind of figure out why. You know, there's so many. Every cartoon in here is a favorite of mine because I picked it, but I'll try to think of a few of them. There's the David Cypress had one with a bar graph showing the sales of Viagra over the years. And, of course, the bar graph early on is somewhat droopy, and then it becomes more, straight up and down.
Right.
It's a great joke to me, a visual gag.
But it's what? It's to what? Explicitly sexual or what?
Not only that, but it's also Viagra, which is a little bit of a lowbrow kind of topic. You can do cartoons about, you know, sex and sexuality, but, you know, Viagra perhaps is overdone and a little too easy. I think Mueller, P.S. Mueller, has some great stuff. There's the Titanic action figures, which is just a bunch of floating dead bodies, which is terrible, but really funny to me. And there's several in here that are funny. But I guess that was, you know, maybe that was a timely thing. You know, it would have been perfect to have it when the movie was out. And then it you know, missed its window of opportunity, so we brought it back.
There's the one from Mike Tui, if I'm saying his name correctly, where he's got a patient, a doctor has a patient on the table, and he's got his backside in the air, and the doctor is saying, well, we couldn't find anything with a sigmoidoscope. Looks like we'll have to send in Junior here. And there's a little guy there in a wetsuit and goggles. It's the picture.
Well, that's definitely, you know, that's a lowbrow kind of a. Me and Mike had discussions long into the night. Well, not really, but we did have discussions about the wording of that, whether it should be we'll have to send in Junior or we'll have to send up Junior.
Uh-huh.
Very, very complicated issue and very important in our line of work. And then also sigmoidoscope. I didn't know that was a real thing.
Yeah.
I thought he'd made that up.
Right,
but apparently
that's
the accurate thing.
And again, this may be just too lowbrow, but Michael Shaw's piece of two Tyrannus Rex are talking. And, of course, they have those shrunken little forepaws up top, and one of them is saying, I'd give up being the most fearsome creature on Earth if I could just reach my weenie.
To me, that's nearly poetry.
Right.
Reach my weenie. I mean, it's a funny joke. And it does reference something that people have sort of beat around a little bit before, the fact that they have small upper arms, but this is a hilarious way to look at it, I think.
But maybe
and the contrast between this fearsome beast and his simple little hopes.
How much do the cartoonists talk to each other, you 38 or 40 people that are competing with each other every week?
Quite a lot, actually. The ones that are living in the city, you know, we drop off our ideas Tuesday morning, and then we all shuffle off to have lunch together and, you know, complain and gripe and... We're kind of a tight bunch. It's not competitive, you know, any more than it has to be, but it's not up to us. So, you know, we're a pretty friendly bunch.
Yeah, fair enough. You just submit your stuff and then you get an answer.
Yeah.
You know, one of the fun things that readers like about the New Yorker is that feature on the back page now where the reader is invited to submit a caption for a picture, you know, you write your own caption. There's a, you know, a kind of an outrageous or funny situation depicted, and you're invited to submit a caption. Yeah. I assume the pros are barred from entering that competition, right?
Right. We're not allowed to submit captions.
It's
hard. I don't know if I could do it that way.
I was just going to say, do you ever do it for fun or no?
No. I mean, some of the other guys work that way. I think they draw themselves into a corner and try to come up with a caption, but... I've tried to work that way, but I just end up with a drawing and I can't think of anything.
Yeah,
but that's an example of how we get accepted and rejected at the same time, because they'll buy a cartoon from you and say, yeah, we're going to buy this cartoon for the caption contest, which means they're going to take your drawing but lose your caption in the hopes that the readers will come up with something better.
Oh, that's where those come from.
At least that's how it's happened for me. I've done it twice and that's how it's happened for me. Maybe some others are just a picture to start with. But usually I think it's a cartoon that we submit and Bob sees something in the visual that would lead to other interpretations.
Yeah, well, what's one that you submitted that had the text ripped
one,
away?
I did one with a little girl playing a violin and her teacher is sitting there kind of frightened and the room is in a shambles. Obviously, something has just happened that completely destroyed the room, and the teacher is very frightened. And my original caption was, okay, once more with a little less feeling.
Okay.
And so I turned that in, and they said, we're going to take it for the caption contest. So they took my caption off of it and then had, you know, I think like 9,000 people enter this thing.
Really?
And they ended up picking as a finalist my exact caption from somebody.
No kidding.
And it was the winner. Which I guess is good.
Oh, how ironic.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's very interesting when you see they break down the entries, and so many people have the same idea. It's fascinating. And many people will have your idea or some really close variety of it.
When a cartoon gets selected for the caption contest, do they pay you less?
No, it's the same amount, thankfully. Okay. Otherwise, I think the cartoonist would revolt.
Right.
Some of the cartoonists are very against this, by the way. They claim that, you know, you wouldn't put a, you know, Rick Hertzberg article in there and leave off the last paragraph and have people write in their version of the last paragraph. I think it's a good thing because I think it's getting people thinking about, you know, what we do. This is what I hoped it would do. I hoped it would make people think, wow, this is really hard what they do. This is tough. But on the end, it's the opposite. Everywhere I go, everyone that's ever done it is convinced that theirs should have won.
Are there any other cartoons in the book you want to talk about and ones that didn't make it in?
Gosh, your once I start.
Once you start.
Know, I mean, Mick Stevens has a great one with Tonto and the Lone Ranger
in
bed together.
Yeah,
it's Tonto and Lone Ranger in bed together, obviously after having some sort of intimate moment. And the Lone Ranger is saying, oh, so that's what kemosabe means. Which is, you know, probably people have been all just around that idea and didn't quite nail it. But, you know, he certainly nailed it.
Right.
And that's what I like to see. As a cartoonist, you know, I've probably thought around a lot of these topics before and didn't quite get the idea. And so to see somebody else just get it, you're like, oh, I should have done that. That's great. So that's what, you know, the book is for me. Cartoons that I wish I had done.
Yeah. That convention of two people in a bed with the covers halfway up, obviously, after an intimate moment, is widely used. And there's this wonderful one by C. Cover Derbyshire.
Yeah.
With a guy with the mice. Do you want to describe that one?
Yeah. So it's a scientist in bed with, I don't know, 20 white laboratory mice, which is already pretty funny. And then another scientist, I guess, has barged into the room or opened the door and caught them in this scene. And I might not get the caption exactly right, but it's something to the effect of, do you have it there?
Yeah, I have it. He said, there are all these mice lined up with the covers halfway up their little bodies.
Yeah.
And he says, yes, it's exactly what it looks like. And no, I don't know where this leaves us and our research.
Yeah. There's another one here I just happened to flip to by Zachary Cannon. It's a homeless guy or a hobo in bed with a lady. And the homeless guy is saying, I really would have just settled for some spare change.
Right.
Which is funny to me. There's another one on the opposite page by Zach that's pretty funny. It's a toilet with a little friendly little face and eyes on it. So it's a talking toilet character saying, today is going to be different. I can feel it. There's something very sad and funny about this optimistic potty to me.
Well, Matthew Diffie, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. It's very fun.
Cartoonist Matthew Diffie. He's edited a book of cartoons that didn't make it into The New Yorker called Rejection Collection, Volume 2.